Welcome to the Nation of Writers podcast, presented in conjunction with our exhibit, American Voices, which you can explore in person or online at nationofwriters.org. In this episode, we'll discuss the life and work of journalist and author W.C. Hines. Most well known for his sports reporting, Hines was one of the nation's preeminent sports journalists during the 40s, 50s, and 60s with a daily column in the New York Sun. Prior to that, he was the Sun's war correspondent during World War II, sending dispatches from the front lines. In 1958, he published his first novel, The Professional, which garnered critical acclaim. He also co-wrote Running Into Daylight with football coach Vince Lombardi, and the novel MASH, which led to the iconic TV show of the same name. Hines was a five-time winner of the E.P. Dutton Award for Best Magazine Story of the Year, won the A.J. Liebling Award for Outstanding Boxing Writing, and his work has been reprinted in more than 60 anthologies and textbooks. He has been inducted into the National Sports Media Association Hall of Fame, as well as the International Boxing Hall of Fame. And following his death in 2008, the Associated Press sports editors posthumously awarded Hines the Red Smith Award, regarded as the highest honor for sports journalism in the country. For this episode, we are joined by writer Bill Littlefield, former host of NPR's Only a Game program, and editor of The Top of His Game, the best sports writing of W.C. Hines, as well as Gail Hines, daughter of W.C. Hines and literary executor of his works. You can read their full bios in the episode description. Bill and Gail are interviewed by Nate King, digital content associate at the American Writers Museum. This conversation originally took place January 5th, 2024, and was recorded over Zoom.
Well, thank you, Gail and Bill, for joining me today on this episode of Nation of Writers. Looking forward to chatting with you more about W.C. Hines and his legacy and what his writing has meant to you in your life and careers. But before we do that, perhaps would you like to give our listeners a little bit of info about yourselves and your connection to W.C. Hines? Bill, would you like to kick us off?
Sure. I hosted and wrote for a radio program called Only a Game for 25 years, an NPR WBUR program. And it was in that context that in 2000, I was told by a friend of mine, Glenn Stout, who was the editor of Best American Sports Writing, that there was this fellow, W.C. Hines, and when Stout and David Halberstam were going through material for a book of the best American sports writing of the past century, Bill Hines was the only guy who had three pieces in it. And he said, you know, they're really terrific pieces. Well, I was a little bit familiar with W.C. Hines because I knew the column, Death of a Racehorse, which almost everybody knows. Glenn and David Halberstam were both surprised that Bill was still around, and so was I. So I got in touch with him, and I drove up to Dorset, Vermont to interview him. And he had told me very specifically not to arrive before a certain hour because he was taking care of his wife and had to get her settled before we could have our conversation. And so I, of course, got up there way too early. I went to a little library in Dorset because I was curious about whether any of Bill's books would be in the library. And there were two. And so I checked some of the stuff out in there and waited until it was the proper time to drive up the hill to the house. And then we went up there and had our interview. And that was my first meeting with him, and had several subsequent meetings over the next few years.
And a lot of correspondence.
yeah, we sent postcards back and forth to each other. And I remember you're saying at one point when you visited your dad saying, oh, look where Bill is today. On vacation somewhere, I'd sent a postcard. But it was in preparation for this conversation, I thought about some of my conversations with Bill and some of my correspondence with him. One of the most exceptional things about him was how incredibly encouraging he was to me. Just one brief story. I sent him a novel called Prospect, which I wrote some years back. And there's a little tiny moment early in Prospect where a baseball scout is trying to talk to a prospect that he wants to sign. And he's sitting at the kitchen table in the boy's parents' home. And he starts pushing a salt shaker back and forth from one hand to the other, just to have something to do with his hands while he's nervous. And when Bill wrote me back, he said, "You had me from the point where the scout starts pushing the salt shaker back and forth with his hand." And I thought, my God, is a dream reader, what any writer wants, somebody who reads his work carefully enough to notice and respond to a detail like that.
Yeah.
But that was absolutely representative. He was a great reader, a great, great encourager of writers. And the list of writers that he encouraged is long, and I'm very proud and happy to be on it.
Yeah. Thank you for that, Bill. What a great story. And Gail, how about yourself?
Well, I first met my dad, I guess, soon after I was born, February of 1951. But growing up with him was a very interesting life. Always lots of stories about the number of characters, you know, he had come to know over the years. Lots of crazy stories about them, of course. And I never realized the influence that he had or the reverence by a number of writers, really, until very, very late in his life and mostly after he passed away, at which point I got calls from a number of newspapers for his obit, cards and letters and awards that came his way, and people saying the younger writers, which is so refreshing and heartwarming, saying, you know, what a giant he was and how much they respect his writing. I remember he was finally, after a few years, given the Red Smith Award by the Associated Press Sports Editors, something he'd been nominated for, but they didn't go for it until, of course, after he died. But my daughter and I flew out to Minneapolis to receive it on his behalf. And after the ceremony, my daughter and I were sitting at a luncheon table with some of the younger writers, and they looked at my daughter and they said, "You probably don't have any idea, but your grandfather is like our Babe Ruth of sports." I think her eyes widened at that point. But he was a very, very humble man, and never really promoted his work much. He always felt that if the work was done successfully enough, it should stand on its own legs, you know, without having to go on morning, evening TV shows and talk shows and radio shows and all of that. I think he would have been much more widely read and known about had he done that. But it wasn't in his makeup to do that. So I think in the long run, maybe he was right. His work stood up very well and is still being read.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, very true. And as one of the young writer, you know, I studied journalism in college, and you know, I remember reading his work as well. And it's because I was, you know, still am interested in sports and writing, and that was my first. I think I had that best sports writer of the century book in which he's featured. Yeah.
So funny, just to interrupt you for a second.
No, go for it.
Excuse me. When my daughter was in college, and she was majoring in communications, and she took a course in sports media. And one of the things that they read was a piece by her grandfather. And of course, nobody knew. And so she was calling me going, "What do I do? Do I say anything?" And it's like, absolutely. I said, "You don't have to announce it to the class, but go to your professor, you know, after class and just let her know, because she'll get a big kick out of that, you know." Yeah. So she did that. And of course, the professor was, "Oh my gosh." And then the professor had to announce it to the class. but it's very heartwarming for me to see that, you know, the legacy goes on.
Yeah. I imagine so. And speaking of that, maybe now's a good time to give our listeners a little bit of a sort of historical framework as far as when your dad was writing, kind of a little short bio just to give us a sense of what was happening in the world when he was, you know, very active, right? He was born in 1915, right?
Yep, 1915, January 11th in Mount Vernon, New York. The only child of German ancestry parents and grandparents, and went through Mount Vernon High School and then went to Middlebury College in Vermont, which was one college that his parents could afford with a loan from friends. And so he would take the train from New York, you know, up to Vermont, and went through 4 years at Middlebury. It's where he met my mother. She was 2 years older. And after he graduated, he went back to New York and got a job as a messenger boy for the New York Sun. He had grown up around books, did a lot of reading, but was most enthralled with athletes and sports, because my father was on the frail side. And although he was athletic, doing track and ice hockey, he could never really succeed in that as a professional. And so he wanted to be near the pros. He wanted to travel with them, which sports writers did back then, by train, you know. So you had a lot of time with them and you stayed in the same hotels. And anyway, so back then you got to know your subjects quite intimately, and he loved that. So anyway, from being a messenger boy to a copy boy, and then he wrote a piece for the New York Sun where he was working on his own about a cleaning lady going to work on the train in the morning, and the editor saw it and loved it. And that started his writing career for the newspaper. And then World War II happened, and he was very grateful that his job was to write about it and not fight. Anyway, he was the junior correspondent for the New York Sun in World War II, doing the European theater. And when their senior correspondent was captured by the Nazis, Dad took over and continued till the end of the war. He was on the USS Nevada, anchored off of the Normandy beaches there for the invasion, writing with his little portable typewriter that his dad had given him in high school and he still used till his dying day. Mm-hmm. he said as the big guns would go off on the Nevada, you know, shelling the coastline of Normandy, his typewriter would jump 2 inches off his desk. But then he went ashore after the invasion and was with the First Army all the way through Battle of the Bulge and Hurricane Forest and all the number of battles across till they met up with the Russians in Germany and ended the war there. After that, the Sun folded in 1950, and he turned down a number of job offers from various newspapers because he wanted to do longer pieces. And so he became a freelance writer, doing articles for a number of national magazines. And when he'd gotten enough money, he wrote his first novel, The Professional, about boxing, and then continued on with magazines and books throughout the rest of his career.
Yeah, thank you for that. And the what I found fascinating, because I learned about him as a sports writer, right? Like that's kind of not pigeonholed necessarily in that category, but is, you know, that's what people know him for. That's perhaps his most well-known work is about that. So I found it fascinating to learn about the war reporting, and specifically how that experience informed the rest of his writing. The rest of his career. Could you speak a little bit more to that of how that experience then impacted the rest of his writing and the ways in which he looked at things?
Well, I know he always said that you know, that the war was a patsy for writers, that it was so dramatic you couldn't write it badly. And people often wondered, boy, you know, how do you go from covering battles in World War II to writing sports? You know, it seems like, you know, opposite things. But he said he found in sports there was that same camaraderie, you know, among the athletes that he found among the soldiers in World War II, and that they were really both battling for each other, as teams do in sports and the soldiers do in war. I think that something that was very influential for him, and you can tell with his writing, was Ernest Hemingway. And he did pattern his style of writing very much after Hemingway. Hemingway was a real hero to him, and to his delight during the war, when they were outside the Hürtgen Forest in Belgium, I guess that was, Hemingway had taken over a farmhouse as kind of his post. And any correspondents that were ever in that area would always stop in and overnight in the attic on cots and mattresses at Hemingway's farmhouse there. So he knew, Dad knew he was going there, you know, the specific day. And he picked up a bottle of scotch on the way and arrived at the farmhouse, and Hemingway was on the steps greeting everybody. And there was Dad meeting his hero and handed him a bottle of scotch. And Hemingway loved it. He grinned, shook his hand, and he said, "Where are you staying tonight?" And he says, "You're welcome to take over my room." And Dad said, "Oh my God, no." He says, "I could never do that. I wouldn't sleep a wink." He says, I'm sleeping upstairs with the guys in the attic." You know? But during their friendship that developed at that time, Bill knows this story very well. Hemingway's typewriter was broken. I think a door had come off its hinges or something during a shelling and fallen on his typewriter. And it was out getting fixed by the mechanics, I guess. And so he asked my dad if he could borrow his typewriter. So of course, father was thrilled, you know, absolutely, you know, and here's that little 1932 Remington portable typewriter. And Hemingway wrote, I'd love to know what he wrote on it. I wish I had it. I don't know what it was, but when he was done, he gave it back to my dad and said, "It's a nice little typewriter. He says, it's got a nice mill to it, and it writes very well." And Dad laughed and looked at him and said, "Oh, sure. It writes a hell of a lot better for you than it does for me."
Which when I got the opportunity to write the introduction for The Top of His Game, the collection of Bill's work, I disputed. It writes differently for the two of them.
Not better or worse.
No, not better or different. Worse. There's no point in comparing the two writers, because each of them has reasons to be admired. But it is an index of what Gail was talking about earlier, which is Bill's humility. There's another story that reinforces that. And that is when Sports Illustrated published a very long and quite wonderful profile of Bill while he was still alive. And the fellow who did it had all the scrapbooks and all of Bill's columns. And somebody talked to me afterwards about the experience of reading all this stuff. And he said, "Well, the most amazing experience about it was that there aren't any bad ones."
Yeah.
And anybody who's worked for a newspaper, worked for a radio station, and produced day after day after day on a deadline knows that that's impossible.
Right.
Yeah. Not impossible for there not to be any bad ones. And yet that was the conclusion. And yet, Bill, I've seen these notebooks, and in order to write the introduction, Gail lent them to me. And there are only a few columns in those notebooks where Bill wrote in penciled good.
Yeah.
he really didn't impress himself all that much, or never acknowledged it. And yet they're all good. I mean, they're brilliant, they withstood the test of time as they should.
Yeah, right. That was also, reading that same Sports Illustrated piece was fascinating to see the little, he would still, even though it was in his scrapbook column, right, or printed, he would still add a little bit of like a little carrot of like, add a little, like, maybe I should have added this little word here.
Or tick one sentence of this pretty good description at the end of this one.
Yeah. Yeah.
Quite lovely. Yeah.
Yeah. Just the sheer output of words too is impressive, even more so that none of them are bad. I'm curious, Gail, perhaps you have insights into this and what his process was like in order to, you know, a daily column. It's like, you know, it was what, 250 columns a year, like, 700 words each.
Yeah.
Words per column. Of course, all of his newspaper column writing years was before I was born.
Mm.
So I have no personal actual knowledge of that, other than I know what an amazing researcher he was. And he would research his subjects to the nth degree in order to get it right. Was always trying to get it right. When he was researching magazine articles, researching for any of his books, he would use those little penlight notebooks, spiral topped notebooks, and because they flip over easily and give a sturdy background. And he would always use a mechanical pencil, so that it never needed to be sharpened, never had to interrupt anything. And if you look at his notebooks, and then he would number the notebooks depending how many he needed for the story. And he would leave the right-hand margin down the side of each page blank for about half an inch in width margin. And after he was done with that notebook, he would go back and bracket whatever notes were on that page, and in the blank space, just make a notation of what it was about, what the subject was that he was talking about there. Then, when he had completed all of his notebooks and his research, he would, on one piece of typewriter paper, make kind of a, like a table of contents almost. And he would put alphabetically all the different subjects that he covered, and then put what notebook, which number notebook, and what page that was on. So when he's at the typewriter and he's writing about Vince Lombardi and coaching St. Cecilia's High School in his early years, he'd go look at St. Cecilia's on his table of contents, get the right notebook, get the right page, and there are the quotes from Vince right there. So extremely organized. And I often wonder if that's kind of a German trait, you know, it's like exact, organized.
He also, besides the obvious benefit of organization, he was a great listener. And there's a story about a column that he wrote about a trainer, boxing trainer, and when he was going to meet with this guy in the gym, it was Jack Hurley, and he was going to meet with Jack Hurley in the gym, and a friend who hadn't seen in a while said, "Can I tag along?" And so he came along, and he sat by while Jack Hurley and Bill Hines were talking, and then they said goodbye, and Bill went and wrote his column, which appeared in the paper the next day. And when he ran into the friend again, the friend said, "Gee whiz, Bill, you must have the memory of an elephant." He said, I read that column, and you had everything that you and Jack said word for word. And Bill said to me, he said, "No. A column's 850 words. He said, I couldn't possibly have everything. He said, what I had was the sense of what the two of us had talked about. But he had the ear to present it as if it was a conversation without pause, an absolutely coherent, complete package. And he was a great a lover of dialogue. He liked to put passages together where people just talked to each other and you got the sense of who they were by what they said to each other. And that's the greatest influence that he had on me as a writer, because I think dialogue is such a great way to present character. And I think it was partly he had a wonderful ear and a great sense of sort of how to convey character through what people say. So those are two pretty important qualities, that and of course, the organizational determination and sense that he had as well.
You know, kind of a funny anecdote. when he was writing for The Sun and doing his so many boxing columns, he would spend many, many days at Stillman's gym, you know, watching the fighters, talking with them and the trainers, et cetera, et cetera. But he would absorb their language and their dialogue in his head. And then he'd go home and have dinner with my mother in their apartment in New York. And they'd be sitting down at the table and he'd start talking and she'd look at him and she'd smile and say, "You were at Stillman's today," because he was still carrying with him the accents, the inflections of these boxers, you know, from who knows where, you know, the back streets and corners of New York and yeah. elsewhere. But
that's a great story. I love that one. Yeah, yeah. you were at Stillman's, weren't you?
well, yes. It's at the beginning. Of Brownsville Bum, which is one of the great magazine pieces, it's right there. People will hate a guy all his life for what he is, but the minute he dies for it, they make him out a hero and go around saying that maybe he wasn't such a bad guy after all, because he was sure willing to go the distance for whatever he believed or whatever he was. There's no punctuation in there. The whole thing is boxing lingo. To a certain point, but there's never, but Bummy went nuts again. He flattened the first one, then shot him. And when everybody read about and how Bummy fought guns with only his left hook and died lying in the rain in front of the place, they all died. They all said that was really something. And you sure had to give him credit at that. He didn't have to write in that kind of vernacular, but he understood that that was precisely the vernacular that was appropriate to that story. Right. Which is part probably of what led Jimmy Breslin to say it was the greatest magazine piece set in sports that he'd ever read.
Yeah, and that, to me too, the cadence of the words in that story and most of his art is
just exceptional.
Is perfection. And also, and it's also it's like a, you know, a boxing match can be like that too, just going on and on and on, and then you know you're like, oh, what's going to happen, and that I do like Bill too, in that that the first part of Brownsville Bum that you read in the intro to that to the anthology, after you quote that first paragraph, you say, "Who could stop reading there? Nobody," I think. Which is true, because now like
absolutely. No, I know.
I'm like, what's gonna happen next? Yeah. Yeah. And so maybe now's a good time as well to talk about some of the, because one thing I found fascinating in doing the research and learning more about W.C. Hinds is those sort of journalistic techniques and methods of kind of the fly on the wall and kind of just listening. And that, which I didn't realize didn't make the connection to new journalism, which, you know, that it's usually that's the way, you know, the era of that to when I was taught is like starting in the '60s with Tom Wolfe and those sorts of reporters. But Hinds was doing that the decade before, and like, and so that was an interesting, you know, the lineage of how that journalism shifted in those decades. And I was unaware of Hinds's impact in that way as well. You know, the specific details, you know, and the importance of what's said, but also what's not said, what's unspoken,
right,
and how much that matters.
You know, Nate and Bill, I came across a quote of Hemingway's from his Death in the Afternoon, which I read and I thought, oh my God, that's exactly Dad. He said, if a writer of prose knows enough of what he is writing about, he may omit things that he knows, and the reader, if the writer is writing truly enough, will have a feeling of those things as strongly as though the writer has stated them. And I went, oh, there it is. I mean, Dad was lean and clean like that. He didn't have to give every single detail to paint a picture. And he put the reader in the scene so that he would feel like he was there. And it was just another example of how similar the writing technique is between the two of them.
I think there's another quality, though, that was critical to Bill's writing and is not so apparent. There are a lot of people can employ that technique of just listening and then being able to recreate a scene. But what Bill brought to his writing was respect. So no matter who he was writing about, he never made fun of anybody. He never shortchanged anybody. He presented a complete picture, and the complete picture was generally powerfully positive. I went back in preparation for this conversation and read the piece about Pete Reeser, who was a ball player and might have been a wonderful ball player, except that he kept running into walls, chasing fly balls and knocking himself out. And thereby shortened his career. And Bill visited Pete Reeser quite close to the end of his life. He was having heart problems and he was managing in the minor leagues and was somewhat diminished. But he writes about him at that point with a tremendous respect and tremendous caring and affection. And that's constant, whether he's writing about baseball players or boxers or racehorses for that matter. It's constant, and it's not common. It's very common in sports writing to use sarcasm. It's very common to write cruelly. You pick your paper and you'll find sports writers, depending on the smart alecky remark and the sarcastic approach. And that was not Bill's way. And I really have huge appreciation for that.
Dad did a piece for a True magazine called The Rocky Road of Pistol Pete.
That's the one, yeah.
Yeah. And this is what he said toward the second paragraph down. He says, maybe Pete Reeser was the purest ball player of all time. I don't know. There is no exact way of measuring such a thing. But when a man of incomparable skills, with full knowledge of what he is doing, destroys those skills and puts his life on the line in pursuit of his endeavor as no other man in his game ever has, perhaps he is the truest of them all.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I've liked too in reading more of Heinz's work and the retrospectives on his on his career and legacy, is the humanness of it.
That's a big
the important. Yeah, how important it was for him to capture the full breadth of the human, not just the star baseball player, the champion boxer, like the understanding that there's a real person there too, not just the celebrity that the readers know them as. And I think that's what separates him too, like you were just saying, Bill.
Another quality is patience. Imagine how difficult it must be for somebody who has to write every day to exercise patience, and yet he did. It's evident in another magazine piece, the one that he did on Red Grange. He goes and visits Red Grange 30 years after Grange is retired or more. And Bill reminds Grange of a film, newsreel that he saw when Bill was a little boy, saw a newsreel of Red Grange, heroic football playing, and was very impressed. And at one point in the
in the story, he asks Grange if he has anything left from his spectacularly successful college and pro football career. You have a jersey or a trophy or a medal, or, and Grange has nothing. He's given it all away. It didn't mean anything to him. And that might have been the punchline, that Red Grange doesn't have anything left from his career. But he goes on and he listens. And at one point, Grange says, you know, I don't even have a letter sweater from college. And Hines says, oh, man, obviously doesn't say much of anything. And lets Grange say, I kind of wish I had a letter sweater. And that's the punchline. After, I wouldn't mind having that, you know. And that's what makes him more human. You know, he's not a saint who's simply given everything away. Still, that one thing you kind of wish he had. And not many writers would have had the patience to hang around for that punchline and then to recognize it as exactly where the story should end.
Yeah.
Really quite a combination of extraordinary talents.
Yeah, and it was fascinating for me to learn about the other avenues outside of sports writing that he did, and of the other other cultural impact he had, like MASH for one was huge. I did not know about that.
Surgeon.
Yeah. And then also the novel writing. I was unaware of the novel writing, but the professional, speaking of Hemingway as well, Hemingway loved that. Said it was one of the, I'm not going to get the exact quote, but the finest book ever written about boxing or about a boxer. And then also
a damn good first novel to boot.
That's what it is, a damn good first novel to boot. Yeah.
The interesting thing, the story for me about The Professional, I had read The Professional in preparation for the first time I met Bill up in Dorset. So I was familiar with the novel. And it bothered me because he so obviously admires the trainer and the boxer, the fictional trainer and boxer that he creates in that novel. And yet he doesn't let them quite come to the triumph that you might have anticipated if Hollywood were making the story. And it bothered me. I came to like the two, and I really wanted them to come out on top. And so when I had a chance to talk to Bill, I said, I got to ask you, you know, you obviously admire and like these two characters that you create. How come you don't let them win? And Bill looked at me and he said, because that's not the way it happens.
Yeah.
And there's a kind of integrity there. Again, how many people are capable of that? You know, somebody leans over your shoulder and says, you're never going to sell this to the movies unless this guy wins. And your answer is, well, that's not the way it happens.
Yeah. That book has been optioned four or five times since 1958 and never turned into anything. Walter Matthau, they'd given Walter Matthau the book to read, I think thinking that he might be Doc Carroll, the trainer. And he read it and said, this is too good a book to turn into a movie. I'm ruining it. And I think I think Dad's feeling, you know, was, well, he understands because Hollywood wants a happy ending, you know, and that's that. I think today's audience is much different. I think there are many successful movies that aren't happy ending movies. And we'll see what happens next. There's an actor out there now who has an option on it. Sort of, he has an option, but he hasn't followed through with it at this point. A number of things have happened over the past year with writer strikes, etc. So it remains to be seen whether anything happens with it this time or not. But it would be interesting if it finally does happen. This is something I wanted to read to you because you're talking about why didn't Bill have him win, but. In the foreword to Dad's book, American Mirror, which is another anthology of some of his pieces about people, Red Smith does the foreword, his buddy Red Smith. And it says that both he and Frank Graham were visiting Hemingway at his Finca Vigia villa there in outside of Havana, shortly after Bill's first novel, The Professional, had appeared. Hemingway had praised the work as the only good book he'd ever read about a fighter and an excellent first novel in its own right. He was still living with it during lunch that day. "Damn," Hemingway said, "but I didn't want Bill's fighter to lose." Red says, "You didn't want him to lose. How about Bill? When he started the book, he knew how he had to end it. But after he wrote the first line leading into the fight, he had to take a day off and walk in the woods to get up the courage to have his fighter knocked out."
Wow.
But I think, you know, Dad always felt the best stories are from the loser's dressing room, you know. Human interest story. He had great empathy for people and wanted to tell their story because it's the human spirit he's talking about, you know.
Right. Yeah. That makes me think of the blanking on the writer, the boxer's name, but the very end of the
Graziano paragraph.
The Graziano.
Graziano piece. Yeah,
the Graziano piece. The Zale Graziano championship fight.
In which it's a long, you know, an article, but the fight is within the piece. The fight is, you know, half a sentence long. What actually happens in the fight.
The name of the article is done for Cosmopolitan magazine, I think, back in the 40s. It was called "The Day of the Fight." So he starts in that morning, you know, with Graziano waking up in the morning, and he spends the day with him and writes this article about it. And the very leading up to a championship fight, which is going to be held at Yankee Stadium. And the very last paragraph, I'll read quickly. "There were 39,827 people there, and they had paid $342,497 to be there. And when Graziano's head came up out of the dugout, they rose and made their sound. The place was filled with it, and it came from far off. And then he was moving quickly down beneath the ceiling of sound, between the two long walls of faces turned toward him and yellow in the artificial light, and shouting things, mouths open, eyes wide, into the ring, where in one of the most brutal fights ever seen in New York, Zale dropped him once, and he dropped Zale once, before, in the sixth round, Zale suddenly, with a right to the body and a left to the head, knocked him out." End of story. Mm-hmm. Mic drop, as they say today, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And the details too are the exact number of fans, the cost of a ticket, all those little details. You know, that's
summed up in mostly one sentence, you know.
Right. Yeah. It's a great case of, and we haven't mentioned it yet, but Death of a Racehorse, which we should talk about next, is also a great case of this, is those very specific details that you'll miss or if you don't have the ear and the eye that Hines had for reporting, you won't think to note that the horse was moved to next to a pile of loose bricks.
Yes,
but that is very important to the story and the emotion of it. And so that's just across his work, those very specific details, the very telling details about the subject or the place or the moment. He's the master at that. Including those and knowing as he's observing a scene, which of those details are important to remember.
That story practically derailed the audio project for the top of his game. After the book came out, the Library of America asked me to record a bunch of the pieces for an audio version. I thought that'd be fine. I'd done a lot of radio work over a lot of years. And I went into a studio in South Boston and spent 2 days in there recording, and everything went fine. I had a good producer and they knew what they were doing until we got to Death of a Racehorse. And I read Death of a Racehorse and broke down. three quarters of the way through. And I said, well, let's try it from the top again. And I read Death of a Racehorse and broke down again. And it suddenly occurred to me that I wasn't sure I could read all the way through Death of a Racehorse without breaking down. And I finally did it. They finally got it in. But my goodness, it was a lot of hard work. It's an exceptional piece. And it is a triumph of holding back, a triumph of saying only what absolutely needs to be said to convey the power of the scene and the story. And nobody ever did it better.
And written on deadline.
Exactly. So, you know, that's exactly my feeling. I mean, you can talk about Hemingway and talk about Red Smith and talk about all the writers that people talk about in this context. But Bill's achievement was really quite magnificent. He wrote fiction very well. He wrote magazine pieces as nobody had written them before, and newspaper columns that people are still reading. How many newspaper columnists has that said? He did it all. And then, as you say, MASH on top of that. So it really was quite an exceptional career.
Yeah, agreed. What about, like, maybe for our listeners who are unfamiliar with Death of a Racehorse, what about it? You can't really tell much about what happens in it without giving away the whole thing, but what about the writing of it do you think still holds weight, still captivates you, Bill, to this day, where you couldn't, you had to, weren't sure if you could get through reading it aloud.
Right. No, absolutely. I think it's what I said. I think it's the restraint.
Mm-hmm.
Gail said it earlier, Bill said the writing about the war was easy because it was so exciting that you couldn't screw it up. Well, first of all, that's wrong. Writing about anything is difficult, and writing about it well is very difficult. And I would think I would happily never have had to write about war in a firsthand way. But I would think that would be extraordinarily difficult, given all of the variables that would come into it, including what you see every day and witness. Bill was able to recognize the power of the story and then to let the power of the story emerge without imposing his ego on it. Look at this big word that I can find to put in here to describe, No. Get out of the way and let the story be as powerful as you can see it is. That was what he was able to do. And he did it brilliantly in Death of a Racehorse. And as Gail says, did it brilliantly on Deadline. So not an easy thing to do.
Right. Yeah. As we're kind of getting towards the end here, was there any topics that about Bill that you wanted to talk about that we haven't mentioned yet?
You had asked about a favorite quote.
Yes, yeah, I did. Yeah,
yeah. From The Professional, and The Professional, of course, was his first novel, and I think over the years really stood up as his favorite of any of them that he had written. But anyway, from The Professional is the quote: "I have known many who have led their fighters to titles, and some who took them right to the end of the rainbow. I have found, however, that destiny controls the passes to these places, and I keep telling myself, trying to believe it, that it is not important, really, how far you go, but how you make the trip." And it underscores, his basic philosophy of doing the best job you can do, that not everybody's going to win the game, but you should always be proud of your efforts and giving the best of your ability to your efforts. He was a bit of a perfectionist. he wanted everything done exactly right, no matter what it was, a project, something, moving the table that goes outside on the patio that comes in two pieces, a slate top and a wooden base. And I remember my husband helping him in the spring to move that out onto the terrace. And fine, centered on the table, fine. My husband's ready to go back in the house. And my father goes, "Nope, wait a minute." He says, "Let me get my ruler." And, he had to measure exactly to make sure it was exactly centered on the on the stand. But I mean, that's the way he was. You know, you do it the right way or you don't do it at all.
Right, yeah. I was going to say that sounds like my own dad. It's like, if you're going to do something, do it right.
Yes.
And like you said, though, you might not win the game. You might get knocked out in the first round. But as long as you did what you could do right, you know, at the end of the day, that's all you can do, right?
And people would say to him, you know, you must be so proud of yourself, you know, your accomplishments. And he would, no. He says, no, never proud of myself, just proud of my work.
I like that, too, yeah. Bill, was there any other?
Well, I'd have to go back to, I mean, there's so much, there's so many passages that I think are worthwhile and memorable. But the beginning of Brownsville Bum is as good as anything in that respect. And when I visited with Bill to do a radio piece the first time, of course, I had it in mind that he would read the first paragraph of Brownsville Bum. And so we had my tape recorder going and he read the first paragraph and I interrupted him. I said, and that's Bummy Davis. And he said, now, and he kept reading, because for him, the package for radio was not the first paragraph. It was the first two paragraphs. And he wanted to make sure that I knew that what I should put in the piece was the first two paragraphs, not the first paragraph alone. I was the guy who was the radio guy, but he was a lot smarter about what ought to be on the radio than I was.
That's great. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I'll leave with one last question. I always like to ask, and Gail, you had some good thoughts on this in the pre-interview document I sent over, but it's the idea of, in this current world we're in right now, how do you think W.C. Hinds would be engaging in the world? Perhaps if he was, at the time when he was actively writing still, like, maybe what would his daily column look like nowadays, do you think? Or
it would be interesting to know, wouldn't it?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the world is just so different now, in so many different ways. But he was so relieved when the Berlin Wall came down and the Soviet Union crumbled, and thought, finally, we can all live in peace. And then, and a few years later, 2001, the World Trade Center comes crumbling down, and terrorism is the next issue. He was very dismayed with those developments, and I'm sure, what the world was going to come to. I don't know how he would be writing today. I mean, in sports, first of all, imagine, I say to my husband all the time, oh my God, can you imagine, Dad, now where you've got biological men, playing women's sports, and now, you're going to have male boxers physically fighting female boxers. The world is turned upside down. But I'm sure, that he would always find, the individual challenges that people are going to face, the obstacles that they have to overcome with all the challenges that are out there now.
Yeah, that's what I was feeling too. And in researching him, is the sort of lack of humanity we see nowadays for someone as a writer who focused so much on the human side of celebrity, of a given well-known name, the lack of that, and just on an individual to individual levels now, like, would be, yeah.
Well, of course, sports writers can't get as close to the athletes anymore. And the athletes, are making so much money. I mean, they had big egos that, you've got TV, you're up against television and the visual world. I mean, I remember Dad would be sitting when he was in assisted living and watching his television in his bedroom, and he would watch one of those sports talk shows, and And oh my gosh, you know, the jibber jabber about this, and let's dissect this, and how about, is this guy going to be traded here and there? And he'd sit there and he'd think, my God, you know, all of this chatter, you know, and noise about what, you know, about what? Sports became such a big industry. Where the sports casters are as famous or more famous, you know, than the athletes.
Right. They bring their ego. Their work is about promoting themselves, not trying to understand the subjects they're reporting on.
Well, and not trying to write.
That's true too.
Not about writing anymore. Look at the world of what's happened to newspapers, look at what's happened to magazines, look at what's happened to publishing in general. It's not really about that anymore. The other thing is that I don't think Bill had any patience at all for fraud. He liked the real thing, humanity, dedication, people who were true to themselves as they could be.
Yeah. And I also like that you mentioned fraud. I liked his ability to kind of see through that.
Absolutely. He could listen to a trainer in a boxing gym spout a bunch of nonsense about how great his fighter was going to be. And then he could cut to the humanity, you know, of that trainer having to eat several times a day because the surgeons had cut part of his stomach away. And that was the only way he could make it through. You know, that kind of treasuring the humanity and discarding the fraud, not celebrating the fraud the way we do to such an extent now.
Right. Yeah.
I think that would be a big difference.
Yeah. I also imagine, again, in just imagining, I think with the way TV is now in terms of streaming services, and you can have like a, you know, 10 episode, each episode an hour long. I'm curious if he would have found that as a different avenue to get to tell the to have the space and time, you know, because on like news nowadays, and it's all so fast, and you know, the news cycles over, you know, sometimes less than 24 hours nowadays. So I wonder if that sort of that sort of approach, the longer storytelling, was it, to me, as I was reading about how he, you know, once the Sun stopped operating, that he turned down other newspaper columns in order to tell the longer stories that he knew were there, and that's what he wanted to pursue. So I just found that parallel with today's media is like that's where you kind of can go, is those longer television series or docu-series. But
who knows?
We'll never know.
Right, exactly. But regardless, like we've talked about, his work is still being read, and it's still...
Well, that's the important thing. Yeah. That is the important thing. What he did, he did. He was brilliant and triumphant. And if this podcast, this conversation introduces Bill's work to more readers, then terrific. I'm delighted and happy for them to be making the discovery.
Yeah. Bill Littlefield helped a lot with that whole idea in taking over the top of his game and choosing the pieces that he did and writing a wonderful foreword. And for people who want to read kind of a sampling of the scope of my dad's career, it's a great collection, because it starts with the New York Sun columns, goes on to magazine articles, and finishes with chapters from his book, Once They Heard the Cheers, which is a very nostalgic book where he travels around the country and looks up some of his old sports heroes that he had covered when they were hearing the cheers, to see what they're doing then and there. And it's fascinating. It's truly human interest, wonderful stories about people he greatly admired in sports. So anyway, Top of His Game came out in 2015 in commemoration of what would have been my father's 100th birthday. And people will enjoy it.
I sure hope so.
Yeah, I can attest. It is quite enjoyable. And I will say, I love this line too, in reading it, that Bill wrote in the introduction, said, "Gail is the sort of daughter all writers should have. or at least all writers who deserve to stay in print. Goes on, but yeah, the work of that both of you did on this is great. And
mostly Bill.
Your pleasure and an honor.
Yeah.
It was great fun.
Yeah, and this conversation has been great fun as well for me. I've learned a lot, and the stories, the personal stories, I know our readers will enjoy as well. So I want to thank you both again for joining me today.
Well, thanks
for the opportunity.
Great to be with you guys.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Nation of Writers podcast, part of the American Writers Museum podcast network. If you would like to learn more about American writers and their impact on our history, our culture, and our daily lives, find us online or come see us in person. The American Writers Museum is open Thursdays through Mondays from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., closed on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. Once again, thank you for listening, and to all you writers out there, thank you for writing.